From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Today, we'll look at recent trends that show, though the light seems to be at the end of the tunnel, Michigan is headed in the wrong direction in the COVID-19 pandemic.
I'm particularly concerned to see reports of hospitalizations going up. I think, you know, as we started to see rises in cases in younger people, we were sort of hoping that hospitalizations would stay low.
We'll talk to an epidemiologist from the University of Michigan about what she sees in the data. Then we'll hear from Jordan Hamilton, a Kalamazoo-based cellist, about live performance and making music during a year of pandemic.
I wanted to create something, especially now, in the early stages of my music career or songwriting career, that, you know, I kind of express myself without words just as much as I'm learning to express myself with words.
Those conversations coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Later on the program, we'll hear from a Kalamazoo-based cellist who's finding ways to navigate the world of physical distance and live performance.
It kind of stretches you in a way, like, man, I don't like that, but I don't dislike it. What is this? Why? And then you start to ask yourself a bunch of questions and you learn stuff about yourself.
That's later on the show. But first, it's like deja vu all over again. 1 year on in this pandemic, and Michigan has one of the highest COVID-19 infection rates per capita, right behind New York and New Jersey. The trends we're seeing right now show not only a spike in cases, but also in hospitalizations, and outbreaks are being linked to schools. This as restrictions around movement and gatherings are easing, and vaccinations are slowly ramping up in quantity and distribution. Here to help us make sense of the numbers and trends is an epidemiologist from the University of Michigan, Dr. Emily Martin. Emily, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what data are you seeing right now that you find most concerning?
So we're definitely seeing sharp rises. I think it's been, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how we're seeing a lot of increases in cases in young people, in younger adults, and in in children. However, I'm particularly concerned to see reports of hospitalizations going up. I think, you know, as we started to see rises in cases in younger people, we were sort of hoping that hospitalizations would stay low. But unfortunately, you know, we have this group of individuals in the state that are not, there's not a ton of vaccination yet because they're lower down in the priority. So say, you know, the 50-year-old age range, younger, you know, 60 to 65-year-olds. So not a lot of vaccination in those groups, but still really high risk of hospitalization. And so we're starting to see those numbers move now. And that's really what's worrying me the most, I think.
Do we yet have information or data around the severity of the cases that are coming in with those hospitalizations?
So, you know, anytime somebody is hospitalized, that's sort of our biggest marker of severity. Because this is a really slow disease to develop, it's still going to take us a little while to see whether we're going to start to see death numbers start to increase. You know, that should be happening over the next couple of weeks if it's going to follow from the hospitalization numbers. And I think we're still waiting to find out about that.
When we look at the, you know, the charts and the graphs of the numbers as they've been over the past year, it certainly looks like we are on a steep incline as we've seen with the two previous major surges in the state. Would you say that we are heading into a third wave or a surge right now?
There's definitely markers in the data that reflect the previous surges. And so I think it is something to be concerned about, that we could be heading in that direction. You know, I know that it's great that we've got vaccine more widely available, but the percentage of the state that's vaccinated is still low enough that we don't have enough vaccine to stop a surge if it were to occur.
So as we've been calling this sort of a race against time, right, between COVID and vaccinations, does that mean that COVID is basically winning that race between the two?
I mean, I do really like this analogy of the race between the vaccine and the virus. And one of the real tricky things about this is the introduction of the variant. it's like you're running a race with somebody and then all of a sudden that the other person starts running 50% faster, right? And so the goal is that we want to win the race. We want to get the virus low in the community as much as possible before that virus becomes replaced by this faster spreading variant virus. So we either need to bring transmission down or we need to bring vaccine up.
Well, when we look at Michigan in comparison to other states, Michigan is doing particularly poorly right now, even when juxtaposed with states that maybe have fewer restrictions in place. What is the explanation behind that? Would it be this new, we couldn't call it the new variant, but it's sort of just now the variant.
Yeah, the variant.
Is that what it's attributable to?
It's probably a combination of a number of factors. And, you know, I think actually the numbers in Michigan are really interesting because we were lower than a lot of our nearby states for a while. We had less of an impact over the holiday season than a lot of states did. And then we've sort of caught up and surpassed them pretty quickly. And so to some degree, this is a little bit of a catch up from us starting out from a lower place. But now we're starting to creep up above where those other states are. Even given that, and it's probably a combination of more of this B.1.1.7 strain that moves 50% faster. So we definitely know that it's here in Michigan. We definitely know it's increasing. It's probably not the main strain that's around. We have a lot of regular old strain of COVID too. Other reasons that this could be increasing, though, we're also seeing in the data a ton of mobility. So we're seeing people moving around. In some sectors, they're moving around almost as much as they were even pre-pandemic. So we're seeing a lot of activity and in gatherings and kind of the reintroductions of activities that people have stayed away from. And so that's creating the ability for the virus to move from group to group, a lot faster than it has been in the last few months.
You know, I like to think of Michigan as a bit of a Cassandra, not only when it comes to the pandemic, but sort of like lots of various concerning elements, whether it's the economy or any sort of social pressures that are going on, that Michigan sort of likes to lead the way in what's to come for the rest of the country. And it sounds like maybe that could be the case here as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. I think that, we in Michigan are really seeing a lot of signs of that COVID fatigue that we've been hearing starting to introduce. And I think once we got to this 1 year mark for the pandemic, there's really this feeling of, a lot of families missed one Easter together. They don't want to miss two Easters together. And so there becomes this tension between this real desire to go back into these spaces and to start doing these activities again. The weather's beautiful. And so people are really wanting to get out there, but with the vaccine hasn't caught up to that same level of activity yet. So we have so much optimism and we're looking forward to this future when we're going to be able to do all this stuff again. And we want it to be now, but it is still a little bit too early.
Yeah. Michiganders definitely like to revel in mild March weather. And this is probably
exactly.
Not the best year for that to be happening. The governor and her administration do not appear at this point to be very interested in dialing back liberties that we feel like we're gaining back or to prevent another wave. Do you think that there's less concern right now because a higher proportion of high-risk people have been vaccinated?
I do think that definitely it changes the ingredients for decision makers, right? Because we have a lot more vaccine in the groups that are most likely to have very severe outcomes. But, COVID can be very serious for younger ages too. I'm especially worried about this, like 50 to 65-year-old age that doesn't have a ton of vaccination yet, but can have very severe outcomes. Yeah, it's complex. I do have to say that, in public health, we sort of see also that economic stress can also be a public health crisis. And so I don't envy them in having to balance these two forces against each other.
Right.
And, because we do have to make sure people are able to earn a living and take care of their families while, trying to keep the health risk as low as possible. And I do think it's definitely a dance between those two sides.
We've been talking on the show lately about the push and pull between regulations versus personal responsibility. And this idea that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And we've heard it even, you know, from some top health officials, that idea. So then why, if the onus then becomes on the individual to restrain from doing it, why not just have the restriction in place then that says not only shouldn't you, but you can't?
Right. Well, and actually, I think that's especially true for the things that we have kept in place, like the masks. That's really an individual level mitigation measure, that an individual has to wear a mask that has little to no economic impact, right? And so I think stuff like that definitely makes a lot of sense. You know, the tricky thing is when we see a lot of, right now we're seeing a lot of cases that have to do with gatherings. And that's not something that really interfaces with an economic sector necessarily, because it's stuff that people are doing in their homes or, you know, in businesses that are open, but not necessarily for the purpose of serving big gatherings. And so it really becomes that really difficult thing to regulate. You know, that's when you start to see these policies that get into things like, okay, well, you can have three households gathering at a time with no more than X number of people, right? It gets very complex to try to make that into a rule, which is really sort of this common sense thing. The common sense piece is the more new people that you have close contact exposure with in a given week time frame, that's how much bigger your contact tracing network gets if you end up finding out that you've been infected. And it's really hard to take a common sense thing like that and turn it into a policy. And I sort of see that struggle nationwide, is how do you actually make that a regulation when it's more just like, please keep it down to smaller groups.
Right. Well, when we're talking about small groups and something that is within the strictures of regulation, should schools be open now that we're seeing also cases going up because of gatherings in schools and not outside of the school?
You know, really, I think that the data is pretty strong that transmission in the classroom can be pretty limited so long as community rates are low. And so in order to keep schools open, I kind of like to flip it on its head and think about what do we need to do to keep schools open, right? If schools are our priority, well, we need to keep rates low around the school. And that doesn't, you know, that means kind of the whole community around the school, but it also means what I call school adjacent activities, right? Not necessarily exposures that happen in the school, but maybe sports or extracurriculars or gatherings that happen. I mean, everybody's sort of in agreement now that school's really important and we need to try to protect it, but it means that we might have to make balancing decisions in other areas, you know, that are going to influence how much virus pressure is around the school.
Coming up, more from my conversation with Dr. Emily Martin. She's an epidemiologist with the University of Michigan. Back in a minute. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. I'm speaking today with Dr. Emily Martin. She's an epidemiologist with the University of Michigan. We're talking about recent trends in Michigan in the COVID-19 pandemic, including a sharp spike in infections and hospitalizations. I want to pivot now and talk a little bit about the role of skepticism in the whole saga. Right now, we're at this place where demand is exceeding supply of vaccine. But do you expect that at some point we're going to see a tipping point where we need more folks to get vaccinated, but the skeptics or those who are at least resistant to getting vaccinated won't be interested in receiving the vaccination that is available to them?
Yeah, I think actually that tipping point is going to happen. We're not too far away from it. I think once we have it so that it's not a scarce resource, I think that tipping point is going to become really, really important that we start planning for it. Because, there's two factors at play. Just because the vaccine is available doesn't mean that somebody is going to want to get it. But it also means that somebody may not go through the trouble to get it. And this is sort of setting aside access issues. Some communities have much better access than others. We need to make sure that's addressed. But you may have somebody that's perfectly willing to get it, but they're going to want it brought to their workplace. Or, they're going to want to be down the street. They're not going to want to drive 20 miles they're not going to set an appointment and kind of go through any trouble. This is sort of what we've learned with the flu vaccine, is that a lot more people get it when it becomes convenient and offered, you know, right there, you're walking by some place that's offering it. They've got one ready for you right now. And then people will get it, but people won't necessarily go out of their way to get it. And so that's what I think we have to plan around as we get to this place where it's like really, really available.
And when you say that you think we're not too far away from that, do you anticipate that we will reach that tipping point then before we reach herd immunity?
I think we will. What I imagine to be is that supply stops being the constraint as we get out of the spring into the summer. And then the summer is going to be this battle of the last couple of miles of trying to get from, 50, 75% vaccination to 80 to 90%. And that's where, speaking to communities that are hesitant becomes important. And that's where making sure that like access and convenience are a priority.
We're hearing stories about people driving hours, sometimes spanning the entire state in order to get vaccinated right now. We need to make sure that vaccines get into all parts of the state. But, it seems like it's a bit counterintuitive, right? The lengths that some people are willing to go or having to go to get vaccinated when maybe the vaccine isn't as desired in a community.
Yeah.
How do you balance those two things, I guess, would be my question.
Yeah, it is a bit of a paradox. The way I like to think about it is that, there are some people in our state that have the means and the ability and the agency to move around and kind of seek out and find vaccines in all corners. There are some people that don't. To the best that we can target vaccine availability, right, sort of geographically located around communities where people don't have that agency, that ability to take a day off of work and drive across the state to get the vaccine, we should be doing that, right? But eventually, I'm hoping that this becomes more of a larger spider web of networks so that as it becomes more and more available, you'll see availability in more and more locations. And you'll see locations be consistently stocked to the point where it then becomes convenient for everybody.
Then let's talk about the idea of flattening the curve. It's something that the state pushed a lot with the past two surges that we saw. Is it possible to flatten that curve again, or are these factors that are sort of converging at the same time, whether it's weather and fatigue and the hope of vaccine right around the corner, is it going to make it much more difficult to flatten the curve in short order and instead something that maybe we'll have to view on a long-term spectrum?
I think we can still flatten the curve, but it's going to take individual decision-making, and that's where it gets tricky because we still have fairly straightforward tools that we know work, right? We know that masks work. We know that being outdoors is safer than being indoors, and we know that smaller groups are better than larger groups. So these are the exact same tools that we had a year ago. And I think the trick is going to be figuring out how to do that kind of connection that people are craving, but do it in ways that are safe enough so that we can ride out the next couple of months until the vaccine gets fully deployed to people.
When we're talking about this desire to return to normal, what's it going to take to achieve something that feels more akin to normal interactions with friends, family, and colleagues? And when do you see that normalcy or that normality being achieved?
I'm pretty optimistic that if the patterns that we're seeing with vaccination continue, that as we get into the fall, we have a chance of being in a scenario where, most of the time things are feeling like they're returning to normal with isolated pockets of outbreaks that have to be contained and monitored and dealt with when they happen. And so we get into this more of an adaptive situation where sometimes things are really high and we might have to walk back a little bit, put our masks back on, but then sometimes things are really low and we're kind of able to continue on to something that feels very close. There are some elements of normal that I don't think are coming back. And one of those is how we view respiratory illness. I think we're going to get away from this pattern that we've always had where it's like, oh, I had a cold and I had a fever and I'm feeling really crappy, but I powered through it. I went to work anyways. And I think we should start preparing ourselves now that we're supporting people in the next like cold and flu season that's going to come you know, a little under a year from now, because I don't think that's going to be happening again.
When, you know, we've seen mask wearing become fairly commonplace during cold and flu season in some East Asian countries that have experienced outbreaks of viruses in the past. And I think from an American standpoint, it was like, oh, that's so strange wanting to do that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I'm going to keep my masks on handy, you know, on hand well into the future, if not forever, because I don't see myself weathering a cold and flu season anymore without a mask out in public.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been thinking the same thing, that I can imagine traveling with a mask, you know, going through airports and airplanes. I always get sick after air travel. And so I can imagine masking up for air travel in the future. And then just generally in crowded spaces and cold and flu seasons, I think I can see me, my family members doing the same thing, that we do selective masking in situations going forward. And, you know, I think this is the first year I can remember since I started working with children that I've ever had a year without being sick. Mm-hmm. And same. So, yes, you know, I'm sold in terms of masking.
Totally. I mean, the hygiene that we are practicing right now, hopefully will be a new normal, right?
Right, right.
Emily Martin is a doctor, an associate professor, an epidemiologist with the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Every Friday, as part of our Creating Connection series, we're sharing personal stories from fellow Michiganders about how arts and culture programs have changed their lives. This week, we visit the shore of Lake Michigan with Great Lakes surfer and surfboard artist, Tim Folkert.
It wasn't really until college that I thought much about surfing. I mean, growing up around West Michigan, you'd go to the beach with your family, you'd jump in the waves. But the idea of actually riding a wave or anything like that didn't really cross my mind. I remember one guy having a board, but it seemed ridiculous. Right after I had moved to Santa Cruz, a few months later, I was back home for Christmas on a walk out by Big Red, the lighthouse in Holland. And it was a blustery, cold, snowy day. And there were about five or six guys in the water at Makatawa, the surf spot just off of Big Red on the south side of the pier there. And having become a recent surfer myself, I was completely like blown away. Like, what are you guys doing? And I ended up talking to a couple of them, and they were sharing their experiences and stories of Great Lake surfing. And they had been doing it for a good number of years already. And I was just kind of taken back and like, okay, this is more of a scene here than I had originally thought growing up. So that was kind of my introduction to Great Lake surfing. Being a board builder in the Midwest is a rare and weird thing, and a lot of people don't get it. And so the first few years moving back here, it was a hard time just trying to be understood and why I would choose to do this, because it's not very lucrative. I do it for the passion of it. I have experienced things out in the water on the Great Lakes that you could never experience anywhere else. Oftentimes we surf in the coldest, harshest conditions that are imaginable. That's why the community here isn't as visible, because we're not out in the summertime when it's all sunny and beautiful. We surf when it's 15 degrees out and the wind chill is -7, and there's these big systems that are rolling across the lake when everybody's huddled inside. We're going out to brave the elements. That's really a unique aspect of surfing the Great Lakes, is you just put yourself in the middle of these big weather events, who experience what's happening out in nature in a completely unique way. The beauty and the solitude and sheer moments of what these weather patterns can do and produce is as beautiful as anything I've ever seen. One of my pieces is called Windshift. It's these sets of triangles that are symmetrical to one another, and they kind of emanate away from each other, signifying the wind moving in opposite directions as it changes. And that's something we experience here all the time. It's part of surfing on the Great Lakes, is you're often either waiting for the wind to shift to be perfect, or the opposite is true. It's going to go bad really fast. A lot of my art is influenced by the stories of the lakes since man has engaged with the Great Lakes, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, and glaciers receded, there's been this story built on First Nations and the voyageurs and colonial rule and all the bad and the good and ugly that came around. I mean, the Great Lakes has its own history, and we are an extension of that history. We are not an extension of the history of Hawaii and California. We're part of something much bigger. And I think that has been what I'm attempting to tell with my artwork, along with my personal experiences on the lakes. We see 5-6 foot days that resemble ocean-like conditions. They'll line up, you can get good turns in. You'll get a few dozen surfers out there and everybody's kind of wide-eyed and like, whoa, is this really happening here? This is special. It feels incredible. It's this release of tension that you've been waiting to release since the last time you had it, and it's just this unique sensation. It was hard to convey to people what I had learned out west, how accomplished I was in 8 years of building custom surfboards out in California under some of the absolute finest craftsmen in the entire world. And so coming back to an area that doesn't appreciate that skill set and trying to, I guess, validate myself in a lot of ways, like, hey, I'm actually really good at this, but not really being able to connect with people at that level and for people to like really comprehend and understand it, it was a struggle at times. But in January of 2018, I was contacted by the Saugatuck Center for the Arts, their marketing director, who said he might have a really neat opportunity for you to display some of your surfboards for this show, Surface Tension, at the Center for the Arts. So I headed down to Saugatuck to talk about ideas of how we wanted to incorporate my boards into the gallery space. My wife had encouraged me to bring a piece of art that I had created and just put on my bedstand. It looked nice and I had no idea what to do with it. So I was like, nah, I don't need to bring that. They're more interested in my boards. That's kind of what I want to showcase. She was like, no, it's really unique. You need to bring it. And to kind of appease her, I brought it and I didn't even bring it in. I left it in the car because I was a little sheepish about it. I had never shown any kind of artwork or anything before. So they started asking me about what my process was like. And I mentioned that actually I had been starting to play around with doing my resin paneling as wall artwork. The same process as I do on a surfboard, but it's on a panel instead of foam. They continued to press me on this. And I was like, okay, I have an example in the car. And so I brought them out to my car and I was blown away that they would even be interested in this. They started asking me how many have you created? And I'm like, whoa, 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 this is all new to me. You are the first people other than my family who has seen this piece. I'd been using leftover materials from the board building process. So this piece kind of appeared over several months. So they wanted 5 original art pieces, including 3 to 4 surfboards. It was the second week of November and the show was opening January 12. And at that point it was kind of just like, yes. And I don't know if I can do this. So we pulled it off and created 5 original art pieces, ended up selling all 5 of them during the show, which was completely mind-blowing to me at a much higher price point than I ever thought possible. And it kind of opened the door for me to realize like this could actually be a thing and could be a good addition to the boards that I build. So this is a piece that I'm working on right now, putting the new resin panel on. I just laid down the color on it. The opening for Surface Tension was a really unique experience for me. Every time they would introduce me as an artist, I really struggled with that title because I was like, I'm not an artist. I'm a craftsman. This is what I've been dedicated to. I'll take the title of craftsman any day. But artist was really kind of, I don't know about this. They were, trust us, you are an artist. I'm like, okay. Yeah, I'll only take it because you guys are saying it, because you deal with it a lot more than I do. So it's turned into a unique outlet for me where I've been selling more pieces. It's still not a full-time thing for me by any means, but it's a good supplement to the boards that I'm building. It was really a conduit for people, my friends and family specifically, to be like, I get it now. I get what you're doing. I get that your skill set is valuable, is unique, is special. And I think maybe that was the moment of validation that my friends and family and people that I haven't seen in years saying, wow, what you're doing is really cool, and understanding it for the first time. Also understanding what surfing means to me in my life, and that, yes, this surf scene is real here and it exists, and you are actually serving a really interesting purpose around the Great Lakes. I'm part of the community. Yeah.
That was surfer and surfboard artist Tim Folkert. Our Creating Connection series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions, and it was funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we'll talk to Kalamazoo-based cellist Jordan Hamilton.
I wanted it to be like, you know, hip-hop people are listening to this, or beat tape people are listening to this and thinking they're listening to a classical record. And then classical people are listening to this and thinking that they're listening to like a hip hop or beat tape record. And it's kind of that in between.
Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. When the pandemic first hit the state last year, Michigan musicians watched their planned concerts and gigs and much of their livelihood disappear in the blink of an eye. Faced with an altered music world, many pivoted to live streams. Some took a moment to pause, and others just dove into new projects. Kalamazoo-based cellist Jordan Hamilton has been doing a little of everything. Stateside producer Mercedes Mejia recently spoke with him about his work. Here's their conversation.
Jordan Hamilton blends classical music, hip-hop, and other genres to create intricate, innovative sonic atmospheres. His latest album is titled Vibrations. Jordan Hamilton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
At the start of 2020, before we knew the pandemic really had arrived in Michigan, what was your year looking like? What were you looking forward to?
Yeah, so I had taken December and January to kind of catch my breath from playing in the fall. And I was getting ready to do a stretch of shows for about 3 or 4 months. And I was going to end it with a 2-week stretch in France. And then I was going to start off around the Midwest, where I would play Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. And so I was already doing a couple of shows 2 weeks prior to the lockdown. I had won like some awards for the album that I released just before that, called My Thoughts Are. And so I was coming off of that, getting ready to make some music videos and go on this long push for that album. And then I got word that, you know, the lockdown was going to happen. And so I had to cancel all the plans that I had, going to Canada, doing some music for that. So it kind of took down all the momentum that I had coming from the beginning of that year.
How did the pandemic change things for you? How did you have to shift?
No, I'm still figuring that out. I find that a lot of things are just unknown right now. We don't know what the industry is going to look like for the foreseeable future. So it's like, can't really make plans for like how I can shift for the future. But what I've been doing lately is just kind of accepting that I'm not going to be able to really play shows the way that I was playing shows before the pandemic. But I can play outside and we can have like socially distanced things, and won't be able to really depend on venues kind of being able to host the amount of people that they need in order for it to make sense for them. So more so getting in contact with the audience themselves directly, and so that we can find a nice place for us to play, making that gap smaller between musician and the audience. So been doing more live streams, have been figuring out how I'm going to play in like parks by myself and just let my fans know they can come up and listen to me if they want. And I've been really just working on my recordings and songwriting because that's what time is allowing right now. So
your latest album, Vibrations, was released on March 17th. How would you describe this album compared with your previous work?
Yeah, you know, these past three records that I've put out, they're first recordings that I've ever put out as like a solo artist. And when I was starting to go along this path, I was thinking that I needed to not wait until I feel like I had the perfect sound. I needed to put this out as I was growing, as I was finding new experiences. And I knew I was going to do like a series of three. And then this one was one that I wanted to put a collection of the songs that kind of influenced the beginning of my music. So I wanted this to be kind of like my classical piece of composition, I guess. I wanted it to be like, you know, hip hop people are listening to this, or beat tape people are listening to this and thinking they're listening to a classical record. And then classical people are listening to this and thinking that they're listening to like a hip hop or beat tape record. And it's kind of that in between.
Yeah, and we have to say, this is you decided to make an all instrumental album.
Yeah. One of the things that I was first drawn to music was how it kind of helped me emote myself without words. I didn't always, you know, kind of express myself with words a lot. So when I was practicing like Bach as a middle school youth, I found a connection and like, oh man, I felt like I said everything I wanted to say, but all I did was just practice this Bach suite. But I was really connected with that, and I think I always have enjoyed instrumentals, so I wanted to create something, especially now in the early stages of my music career or songwriting career, that, you know, I kind of express myself without words just as much as I'm learning to express myself with words.
You're a classically trained cellist, but your solo work explores a lot of other styles, from classical to hip hop. What do you like about moving between those different genres?
I think one of the things that we've all experienced in today's age is that diversity is very needed in our own entertainment and in our, you know, everyday lives. And I find that with like my musical journey, me being a cellist, trying to figure out where the cello fits, I've always run into a lot of different styles of music, because being boxed in like a classical music training is kind of like only one genre for the rest of your life. And so when I decided I wasn't gonna only do that, I kind of started started putting myself in many different places to see what actually works, what actually fits with how I want to express myself on the cello. And I enjoy the effect that a diverse amount of experiences has on your psyche and has on your mind. It's like it kind of stretches you in a way of like, man, I don't like that, but I don't dislike it. What is this? Why? And then you start to ask yourself a bunch of questions and you learn stuff about yourself. So
if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jordan Hamilton. He's a cellist and music teacher based in Kalamazoo. His latest album is titled Vibrations. Jordan, both in your previous work, the album My Thoughts Are, and in your latest album, Vibrations, you create these really beautiful, intricate, layered soundscapes. Can you talk a little bit about your process for building these compositions?
I kind of wanted these to tell a story in a way of a reflection and action, or just, you know, stasis, you know, just being still. I recorded these songs, the first song, Radiation. This is a very like orchestral sound with a beat, you know. And I wanted this one to feel a little bit powerful, to feel a little bit angry, to feel a little bit uncertain, but clearly something needs to happen. And that's why I have these little arpeggiating, and I kind of have this melody that sort of resemble something that's going to come in the next song, Reflection, that sweep like a chorale inside of the Bach big suites. So I did that, and then I have us go into the next song, which is Reflection. And I started this one off with the Bach chorale that's from the St. Matthew's Passion. And in this passion, these chorales are used as a point to like reflect on one's own own doing, maybe their sins or maybe some actions that they've committed that they're not so proud of. And they're going through this whole mass and listening to the story of whatever, you know, it could be the crucifixion or something. And at these points, they're, you know, reflecting on like, oh man, that happened in this story. What does this mean about me? So I wanted to use that in this album as a point to kind of take us somewhere completely different. You hear coming from this loud rumbling, a lot of energy from this orchestral sound, and then all of a sudden you go into this stasis of like, whoa, where am I? And from there, we go into another Bach piece, the prelude from the D minor suite. And this one is very contemplative. It's a little bit brooding. There's certainly some things that are worked out on a sad type of spectrum of emotion inside of this song. And I wanted to pair those together because it's like, okay, let me reflect on some things that maybe may feel painful or have felt painful for me in a recent period of time. And so giving people that space to kind of feel that, I wanted to put that on the record and follow that with another song called Solar. And Solar is just this song that comes right out of the D minor prelude and kind of keeps us in this. It's a short little song, but it kind of puts you in a space of, for me, stillness. Represents some stillness in my life. I named it Solar because, you know, light is kind of one thing, or the sun is something that we can all agree on. Something that kind of affects us, but is still stable. We all feel the heat from it. We all feel joy from it usually. So to me, it's just a brief point of reprise right after you go through that emotional reflection from radiation and reflection.
It is absolutely beautiful. Jordan Hamilton, his new album is called Vibrations. You've recently started a live stream series that's part interview, part performance. Can you tell me a bit about the series and what audiences can expect?
Yeah. Well, every month I am going and I'm finding an artist that I enjoy. I maybe played with them before in the past or haven't got to play with them yet. And one thing that I miss the most about performing on the road is meeting new musicians and just talking to them, seeing where they're at, seeing what's up, you know, see what connects us, see what disconnects us. And I wanted to kind of find a way that I can replicate that experience online. So I've created this series called the Green Room Series, and we have an interview or a conversation online, and we release that to the public. But then at the end of the month, every last Sunday, we split a virtual bill. Well, I'll play some with I may bring a friend on to play with my solo set, or I'll just play solo set. I'll hand out some merch. I'll talk to the people that follow me and then we'll listen to the artist that I brought on for that month. This month is going to be Dudley Music. He's an artist from New York. He's like a loop artist, jazz musician, plays saxophone, keys, raps, sings, and produces music as well.
A lot of musicians have told us that the past year has been really tough financially, with canceled gigs or new situations at home. What has this past year been like for you in terms of figuring out just a way to get by?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I was living a glamorous life before this. I mean, being a musician already has its, you know, troubles with financials anyways, because it's kind of season to season, gig to gig. So I think some of those tools that I used to get by before pandemic helped me get through pandemic financially, especially with some of the assistance from unemployment or the STEMIs, the stimulus checks. So it's the way that I survived like the whole year was because of unemployment and the STEMIs. And I just kind of saved up all of that money, and I use it when I need to use it, and just like hoping that the rainy days will sort of stop soon.
Right. Do you think the live streams have helped at all?
Not really. I mean, it helps with, you know, the passions of musicians to try and get music out, and the passions of music lovers to try and listen to music live. But I think the rate that people are going to live streams is not that much, because everyone's already on a computer. Everyone's already on Zoom all day to go to meetings or to talk to their loved ones. And so tuning in for a live concert sometimes at the end of the day and then paying for it is not everyone's priority. Like going out and like having a drink at a bar and seeing their friends and having a conversation and then listening to some music, it's not quite the same, but it is nice because people do still show up. So it's like a happy medium, but it hasn't really solved the problem. But it's been great for, at least I speak for my own, like it's good for me because it kind of gives me something to look forward to perform and share and connect with people that want to listen to my music.
This has been a really strange and difficult past year for everyone. I'm wondering, what's been getting you through?
The music. Yeah, the music. I think that through the ups and downs that I've had, you know, a lot of the projects that I've been working on have really been monumental. I feel like time passed really fast in 2020. I still think it's last year was 2019. So, but I've kind of measured it by like, oh, I was working on this project at this time, or I was working on this project at this time, or I did this live stream around that time, or, oh, that's what happened, you know? So I think it's been very helpful to have music, to have a passion that I would stay home and do anyways, you know? So that was great. Also, I loved my outdoor walks that I got to take and, you know, kind of take a little break and enjoy myself, check in with myself. Having good conversations with friends and family has been a great thing as well. So those are a few things that kind of got me through.
Jordan Hamilton is a cellist and music teacher based in Kalamazoo. His latest album, Vibrations, is out now. Jordan, thanks so much for talking with me. It was really fun.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That was stateside producer and director Mercedes Mejia. You can catch Jordan's next live stream performance this Sunday, March 28th. For more information, visit jordanhamiltonmusic.com. And that's the show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhen, Mel Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Laura Weber Davis. I'm sitting in for April Baer, who will be back on Monday. Thank you so much for listening.